Now, I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties, bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to contact us, you could send us an email at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the last five, the most recent ones, including this one just as soon as we get off the air, are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. This time we're going to be talking about fear. And we always announce the topic a little bit in advance. So we got quite a few people, and I see we've got quite a few participants now. Thank you very much for being here. And I think that we're going to first talk about what type of fear has impacted a successful negotiation. What kind of fear are we talking about? I mean, there's fear of snakes, but that's probably not it. So, I see we have lots of participation, and we had quite a bit of input beforehand, too. And I think that I'm going to call a lot of the comments, we've got kind of a leading fear. we've got a candidate for spot number one. And it's rather the fear that you're not competent to lead the group. It's kind of a personal fear that maybe we're inadequate or we're not competent to lead. You know, we've got quite a few people saying that they fear that they're not an expert on the issues at hand, and therefore they won't be able to know what kind of goal to set and how to get us on the right path. They're not an expert on the issues at hand. Quite a few people in that rather a vein are saying that they're not experienced enough. Which is, well, an expert is really somebody who has specific knowledge, and experience is, of course, what we gain, not experienced enough. Mm-hmm. This is a kind of an unusual one, but I suppose it happens that quite a few people are also saying that they fear that they're not getting the proper respect from the group, that they're going to not be respected by the members of the group as the leader. Mm-hmm. And there's also the fear that's caused by prior failure, which makes people overly cautious. That's a good one. Fear caused by prior failure. And it does make us kind of cautious. It makes us kind of gun-shy. I suppose that's an Americanism. But it means to be, well, too cautious, too unable to reach a decision. Mm-hmm. Ah, here's one that's quite popular as a fear, popular being a funny word, I suppose, but quite a few people are saying that they've had a prior bad experience with a group participant, and it makes them kind of fearful of leading the group, fearful of being in the group, because there's somebody there that they just don't get along with, and they've had a prior bad experience. Uh-huh. And I don't know if this is related or not, but quite a few people are using the word intimidation, that they're intimidated by the other group participants. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they feel intimidated. So those are kind of competency fears, huh? We feel, usually we're the leader or the third party impartial, which makes us the leader, or we're the conductor of the seminar and workshop, or we're the leader of the negotiation. And we kind of secretly fear that we're not going to do a good job, basically speaking, that we're not a sufficient expert on the issues, that we're not experienced enough, that the group is not going to respect us as a leader sufficiently, that we've had a prior failure making us overly cautious, mm-hmm, that we've had a prior bad experience with a different member of this group when we were probably in a group before, and that makes us kind of fearful, and that we feel intimidated by the group participants. I think those are all really valid and really common fears, and a lot of people are agreeing and are stating them in kind of different ways, but it's really the concepts that we've got here. What have we got? About half a dozen of them. That it's the concept of what kind of fear will impact the negotiation process adversely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about these sort of competency to lead fears before we go on to the next one, because we've got a runner-up. We've got a second candidate that I can see here. But thank you for all of your participation. Thank you for being here. So let's talk about these in order and decide what to do about them. Yeah, because this is a practical show. We don't just talk about theory and ideas that have, well, not a real practical use. No, we want to know what to do. Now that we've found out that these are fairly common and a lot of us have them, let's find out what to do about them. So I think that the first one was our fear that we're not an expert on the issues. Mm-hmm. And that we really don't feel competent to lead the group because we're not an expert. Mm-hmm. And Tony and a lot of other people are saying, well, that can be fixed. You need to research the topics beforehand. It's a good point. We all know what it is that we're going to basically discuss, what the issues are, and what our goals will probably be, although we discuss that with the group and decide what the goals are. But we have a good idea beforehand, and we can do some research on the topics beforehand. A lot of people are agreeing, yes, do some homework, do some research. You know, my rule, and those of you who have been here before have heard this, and if you'd like to hear prior shows, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow has all the shows. Last five are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. And we've said before, and this is one of my little rules about doing any kind of a mediation or a community get-together or a workshop or seminar or whatever, if we're going to have something that's a fairly complicated issue and there are reports and there is research that the sides would like us to see, they need to send it in ahead of time. And it's perfectly reasonable to ask for it ahead of the first meeting so that we can see what the issues are and we could do some research for it. As Antonia says and others, research the topics beforehand. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people like Michael and others, and thank you for all of your participation, are voting that you should ask for outside expert advice. Yeah, we can bring in an expert. Or you could consult with an expert and get some ideas, get a take on the issues so that you can, well, you won't become an expert overnight, but just so that you can have some basis. Mm-hmm. I like to do that. I like to get the sides to send me something so that I can see what we're doing beforehand. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Shao and others are saying that's really soliciting group input, and it is. Who am I going to ask better than my fellow participants? Mm-hmm. That's soliciting group input. It is. And sometimes I do consult an outside expert too. And sometimes the group would like to hear an outside expert, especially if the issues are quite complex. Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of people are making a comment about funding. If you need to call in an expert, it's an expensive proposition. Sometimes they might be interested in volunteering their time, just like we have, in order to get the issues settled, in order to create precedent, in order to do some good in the world, yes. And sometimes experts are within your reach, within your group. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have to be a paid expert, although that's nice if you've got the budget for such a thing, yes. So we can develop some expertise, we can ask experts, and we can solicit group input. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good idea. So now we're going to be sufficiently competent as, well, a new expert on the issues. Doesn't mean we know everything, right? Because certainly even regular experts don't know everything. Good point. A lot of people are saying, well, experts are not the be-all and end-all. Now, the second one we talked about was that we don't feel experienced enough. We fear that we're not going to be able to handle it because we don't have a lot of experience. Yeah. Oh, I see. There's a lot of comment on that. Thank you for all of your participation. Justin kind of sums it up. He says that you'll never have experience if you're always worried that you're not experienced enough and decline. That you'll never have experience if you're always worried that you're not experienced enough and decline. You know, it's a real good point. Experience is just that. It's doing it lots, right? And it's true. Justin makes a very good point that if you never try it, how are you going to get the experience? But the trick is that you can gain some experience before you deal with paying clients, so to speak. It's before you deal with something really complex. Deshi says you can gain experience by volunteering to shadow and assist a more experienced negotiator. Yeah, good point. A lot of very experienced negotiators, we all get very busy. And there is, if it's not client-attorney privilege, if it's not a privileged communication, the negotiation, and sometimes it is, sometimes it can't have extra people, but you could volunteer to shadow and assist. Mm-hmm. Kind of like being an intern, really. Yeah, you could shadow and assist a more experienced person and see how they do it. Good point. Noel and others are recommending that we could volunteer with community groups. Yeah, they can always use somebody with good sense and patience, and it gives you a lot of experience in dealing with different types of people, doesn't it? You can volunteer with a community group. Sometimes they're not adverse sides because they all want the same things. They just have to get together to form it. You know, the best kind of community group to get together with if you want to really volunteer and get some negotiation experience and experience talking to other people, and this is being brought up by a lot of folks, and it's a really good idea. You know, a lot of organizations have a fundraiser, right? And sometimes it's even an auction where you have to procure items and you have to ask businesses for things. Well, that's dealing with different kinds of people, and it's going to a good cause, yeah, and dealing with different kinds of people and different kinds of needs. And it's a good cause, and it works out that you're getting some experience. You have to deal with the people in the organization. You have to deal with the hall, the place where it's being held, the venue. You have to deal with the people donating and collecting the donations and like that. And it's very good negotiation experience. It doesn't have to be something where you actually sit down with adverse groups in a formal mediation or formal negotiation. No, you can get experience dealing with all kinds of personalities and help a good cause besides. How can that be a bad thing? Right? Right. Yeah. Thomas and others are saying you can also volunteer as an intern. Mm-hmm. A lot of places would love that, especially charitable organizations and organizations that are working towards a good cause. They're always low on funds, and you can volunteer as an intern. Yeah. You might even work your way up, but you don't have to. And also, of course, a lot of organizations have interns that earn credit, school credit. Mm-hmm. Even better, because they get something, too. You get something, too. So you might be in a school setting, you know, back for your master's or whatever, and you might negotiate with the head of your department that you'd like to do an internship for real-world experience. Nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. And then Carolyn and others are saying that if you fear that you don't have enough experience, you can take classes on mediation skills. Yes, take seminars, take workshops, take classes. I do some of them. Yes, so quite a few of you are saying you've been to some of my seminars and workshops. How nice. Yay. Thank you for being here. And yes, take classes. Learn from somebody. It's good. Now, this is an interesting point. You don't even have to leave your comfort of your own home. You can look at YouTube and look at how other people do it. Yeah, and get some tips and some skills. And yes, there are indeed the college classes that, I wonder if they're international. In the United States, I know we can take them. I don't see why not, although they're in English. But yes, they are, various colleges give online courses that are free. I don't know if they do it on mediation, though. People are saying yes, because I've seen quite a few. They're more like on science and business and music and things like that. Some of them are in mediation. Good. I'm impressed. Excellent. So all of these things give us experience. Some of them, of course, more hands-on than looking at a computer-generated class, but still, they give you an idea of how to handle the hands-on. Yeah. And I'm very big on volunteering for a good cause, and that's doing a fundraiser. There's a surprising amount of hands-on experience in one of those, because we've all got the same goal, but we all have different ideas on how to get there, and usually we're working on a small budget. Yeah, and because quite frankly, we want more money to go to the organization, right, and not just go towards the party, not just go to the fundraiser. Yeah. So shall we move on to the next one, which I believe is respect, that you will fear that the other group participants will not respect their authority properly, will not give them respect. And, you know, a lot of people are giving me the phrase respect must be earned. And that is true. You cannot... It's very easy to lose the respect of other people if you act in an inappropriate manner. But how can we earn the respect fairly promptly? Because otherwise we get a funny group dynamic if the group doesn't respect the leader or doesn't respect each other participants. We need to have a group that has respect for each other, or else we won't get very far. Yeah. Park says that you earn respect by being well-prepared. I'll go with that. Earn respect by being well-prepared. And I'm getting a lot of agreement. When I do a mediation or a seminar or a workshop or whatever, it is true, those of you who have seen me, I do not actually read off of notes. And I don't have a PowerPoint, because that's not necessarily being well prepared. Now, do I have some notes and some backup facts and things like that? Yes, I do. But I don't generally refer to them or look down at them when I'm making a presentation, because it's dull. But I am the most prepared person in the room. I know who everyone is. I got an idea of who's in the room. I have asked and I have thought about each of their sides. I have done research. I have read everything that has been submitted very carefully. I am prepared. And therefore, the park is correct, and I've gotten quite a bit of agreement. Therefore, I will be respected as the leader because I know what I'm doing. I'm all prepared for this group. I'm prepared for the issues. Yeah. And so that's, and also, Humiko is also saying, and others are breaking out the concept of the civility rules. She said that you earn respect by being a good example of civility and competence. A good example of civility and competence creates respect. Yes, we must all be a good example of civility. If I don't respect you, the group, the other participants, by being civil, and we've talked about civility rules before, and by being competent, that's being prepared, then you won't respect me. because there's nothing to respect. I haven't earned it. And you need to be civil and competent and to be, as Jordan puts it, respectful of others. Yeah, you need to be respectful of everyone and they'll respect you. It goes both ways. You have to remember that these things go both ways. Yeah. And a good example, some people asking about the civility rules. And thank you for all of your participation. You know, we talk about the civility rules with some frequency. They are not, well, sometimes they are written down depending on the group, come to think of it. And quite a few of you guys advocate that. I know I see quite a few regulars, and thank you for being here, to advocate writing down the civility rules so that we can look at them. But they are the common sense rules about being polite, giving everyone their turn, acting respectfully towards each other. Yeah. And they are important to model so that you can indeed have respect, because they are all about that. They're all about being respectful of other people's opinions, of the time that they're putting into this group, and of their efforts. Be respectful, yes. And that will cause you to be respected. Mm-hmm. People are saying that they thought respect was more in the area of respected because of your expertise. Well, I'm going to say that falls under the fear that you're not a big enough expert, right? That you don't understand the issues properly. And as we've discussed, that's kind of a research and ask others type problem, fear. And I think that perhaps the respect one is just ask respectfully to each other. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, they need to respect your abilities, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, shall we move on to the next? Yeah, I'm getting some agreement that, yeah, we've kind of talked about this one. And I think the next one, if I'm not mistaken, right, is prior failure, which makes, where we fear to fail again, which makes us overly cautious. Yeah. Fear of failing again is what it really is, fear of prior failure. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a very good point. Sharon says that if you're worried about your prior failures, you need to remember that the present group doesn't know about your prior failure. You know, that's a really brilliant observation. It's true. Unless you've got somebody in that group or it hit the news or the internet or something and everybody knows about it, the present group doesn't know about your prior failure. Only you know about it, and you need to consider it and think about what went wrong, but not let it freeze you, not let it keep you from being effective because you're so scared that it's going to happen again. Well, it probably won't, because you saw what went wrong the last time, and this group doesn't know about it, so probably you shouldn't tell them. Yeah. As Kyle says, you need to analyze what caused the failure and seek not to repeat that mistake. Analyze what caused the failure and seek not to repeat that mistake. Yeah, we're going to think about it. Sometimes things collapse. And you know what? It is a little bit a matter of lack of experience. Because I often say on these shows that sometimes failures are a more instructive experience than successes. Yeah, so you want to think about what went wrong, not fear it, but just not do it again. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an interesting point that I didn't think about that's being made by Peter and others, that it doesn't have to be our prior failure. It couldn't be a failure of a different group. Excuse me, took a sip of water. A different expert. Somebody that you respected, and it's something to do with similar issues, and they failed. And you go, well, if they failed, how am I going to succeed? And the answer is it's not exactly the same issues. And, well, you've learned from their failure, so you won't do that in the same way, and you'll create a success. Yes, you'll learn from other people's failures too. That's a very good point, and I didn't even think about that. Good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Laura and others are making a good point too, that caution is not really a bad word, that it's really a good idea to be cautious because it prevents us from being hasty and from blowing the civility rules because we are kind of impetuous. That caution might really be a good idea and is not a question of fear. It's just, well, last time perhaps you were a little bit hasty. Or somebody else was a little bit hasty, and that caution might be a good idea as long as it doesn't prevent us from moving forward. I think that's the key, don't you? That you can't get so frozen because of a prior problem that you can't seem to move forward this time. Mm-hmm. Nietzsche says that you need to learn from the failure and move on. Good point. Learn from the failure and move on. So, we had not such a good session once, but we're going to learn from the failure and move on. So, what's the next one? I believe we fear being the leader. We fear taking on the project because we've had a prior bad experience with a participant. Prior bad experience. We don't like each other. We something happened. We have prior bad experience. You know, I'm getting a lot of votes, and thank you for all of your participation from Evelyn and others, that you should try to get rid of the participant. That's a good point. Dismiss the participant if possible, as Evelyn says. Well, yeah. If that's possible, you could rearrange the group, maybe, if there's more than one leader, right? You might not be the only one. You could rearrange into teams and not have that person on your team. You could make subgroups. Dismiss may not be possible because they are a participant for a reason in this group, too. But you could use an avoidance tactic, if possible, to reshuffle the group so that this person with whom you have a bad relationship is not directly in your group, in your subcommittee, in your team, on your team. Mm-hmm. If that's not possible, which sometimes it is not, depending how big the group is and how many leaders. Douglas and others are saying that you can have a one-on-one discussion concerning the impact of prior relationship on the present negotiation. Have a one-on-one discussion with the person that you had the bad experience with concerning the impact of your prior relationship on the present negotiation. Yep. I am a great believer in the direct approach. I'm getting some votes no, that it won't make a difference and there's no sense to talking with the person that probably was in the wrong the first time. But, you know, things change and opinions change and the issues are undoubtedly different now or we wouldn't be talking about this. And so a one-on-one discussion might be an appropriate thing. Mm-hmm. It's certainly worth a try. Have a one-on-one discussion concerning the impact of the prior relationship on the present negotiation. Mm-hmm. And I think even if that does work sometimes, but if that doesn't, and there's a good chance that it might not, you know, it doesn't hurt to try. I've got quite a few people, and thank you for all of your participation, arguing for full disclosure, and I am a great believer in it. I read and others say that you reveal the prior relationship to the group, that you make full disclosure. I would go for the one-on-one first, maybe, but I would reveal the prior relationship to the group if it has an impact, if there's a reason to, if it's something that will impact the group, even impacts the dynamics. I am a believer in full disclosure. I really am. And I don't have to make a big deal about it. I mean, you can just mention when you're going around the room introducing yourselves, for example, or, you know, saying something about it. You could mention that this person is my ex-spouse. I mean, or my ex-boss or something. You know, that's full disclosure. It shows everybody that there is a prior relationship, and it's not all that good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you don't have to fear it. Just, well, disclose it and kind of mitigate the damage. Yeah. And really, it doesn't have to be a showstopper now, just because it was in the past. Mm-hmm. And now the last one is intimidation by the other participants, that you fear being leader because you're intimidated by the other participants. You know, that's being taken in two ways, and this is interesting because I looked at intimidation as the other participants are so experienced or important that I'm intimidated by them. You understand what I mean? A kind of a professional intimidation. Oh, they're so much higher in level than I am. That's a type of intimidation that would make you fear to be the leader because you go, well, you know, what am I doing here? They're so important. But quite a few people took intimidation to be more of a coercive, either physical or a lack of civility type intimidation. And those are two very different things. Mm-hmm. You know, on the first kind, I think Hazlitt pretty much sums it up. He says that when you've got participants who seem so much more important than you are, you have to remember that they may seem very experienced, but they wouldn't have called you in if they didn't need a third-party impartial. They wouldn't have asked for you. You wouldn't be there. You wouldn't have been called in to direct the group if they didn't need somebody to do so. So even if they're more experienced, or even if you're rather intimidated by their credentials and things, well, they wouldn't have asked for you if they could do it themselves. Right. So they need you. So it's important not to be intimidated because, quite frankly, they need you. They need your help. Mm-hmm. And on the coercive one, which I gather has happened to quite a few of you. I'm sorry. Yes, and thank you for all of your participation. I'm getting some examples of coercion, kind of intimidation that something bad will happen if you decide one way or another. You know, Carmel says that a coercive intimidation when you have coercive intimidation, you need to analyze the group dynamic and you may need to recuse yourself. You may need to say, I don't need this as a headache. I'm not going to do it. And as Barbara says, you could threaten to quit if the civility rules are not met. Well, if you've got coercive intimidation, I think the civility rules are seriously not being made. And it's a good point that you could say, well, you know, I'm not going to stand for that. I won't be a party to this. You're going to have to stop that. That's all there is to it. And if you see coercion of other participants, same thing. Got to divide them up. Got to refrain to recuse yourself, whatever it is that you need to do. But that is a serious violation of the civility rules, isn't it? That we all act in a respectful manner towards each other. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So those are the types of fears that I'm going to call competency fears. We fear that we're not going to be capable as a leader of the group, capable as a participant in the group. But there's another type of fear that is quite a few people have commented on that is I'm going to call it a fear of the other participants. Just a fear, not of our own leadership, but a fear of dealing with the other participants. A lot of people are calling the fear of the unknown or fear of strangers because we don't know these people that are in our group, and we're kind of fearful of dealing with them. And a lot of the fearfulness seems to be cultural bias causing the fear or preconceived notions that we just can't deal with that type of people. And it may not even be our biases or preconceived notions, but it may be within the group, the participants, when they deal with each other. And, you know, we talk about group dynamic, and it's kind of an overused word, but it's a real good point that groups do have a dynamic. They have a feel to them. They have a way that they're going to go. And that has to do with how the participants interact with each other. And so it's not just our fear, but it's the relationship fear and the group dynamic of distrust. So let's talk about these, just like we did with the competency fear. So the first one was fear of strangers, really. That we don't know these people. How are we going to deal with them? How are we going to handle that? You know, and Pat makes this very well said, says that everybody is a stranger until you get to know them. Well, yeah, all of your friends were strangers when they started out, right? Everybody's a stranger until you get to know them. You know, and this is, a lot of you have actually seen me in action, and thank you for being here. Thank you for all of your participation. Stephen and others are mentioning that if the group really doesn't know each other, and we're going to have to work together fairly closely, or we're going to need to work together in the future, because sometimes I'm doing a seminar, something at a what they call a compliance seminar. There are certain rules concerning employee behavior in the United States that needs to be complied with. And the people need to be able to interact again, even if the seminar itself is fairly short. So I usually have an activity, which Stephen is calling a story activity, but a lot of you are mentioning all the activities that I have. An activity to get us talking to each other. Like, tell me something, tell me your name. But your name may be on a name tag, so that's not very necessary. Although if you have a lot of people with a little bit unusual names, interesting to see how they pronounce them, yeah? Tell us who you are and a little bit about yourself. Or tell us one interesting thing you did last year. You know, one of those story activities. So we get to know each other, and you'd be surprised. There's quite a bit of common ground in all of that. Things that people like to do, and oh, I like to do that too. Yeah. And so that also creates an introduction. As Julie calls it, an introduction telling about themselves. And a story activity. Do something to get people not to be strangers. It's easy enough to do. And then you know something and you see some common ground. Oh, I like that too. Oh, I saw that movie. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. My kids go to the same school as yours. Yeah. Oh, I live in the same neighborhood. You know, Corey and others are making an interesting point that it's better if there's no prior relationship because you can form a more efficient group. That's a good point. We just talked about prior relationships and might not be such a fancy good thing. So it might be better. You might be able to form a more efficient group if we all start as equal unknowns to each other. Yeah, what a good idea. Shall we move on to the next, which I believe is cultural bias. Sometimes we fear a different group of people because we just know that they're just not like us. and they do the strangest things, and we won't know what to do about it if they get up and do one of them. Mm-hmm. That's a cultural bias. And they're usually, well, I won't say wrong, but they're usually not anything to cause fear of someone else because they come from a different culture. Yeah, that makes them wrong. People are saying that makes them wrong. Well, we all have cultural biases because we've seen and done things that we think are the right way of doing it. Let's face it. Yeah. So we need to, as Gerald says, we need to recognize our own biases and the bias in others and control it. Got to think about it, huh? Got to recognize it. Say, wait a minute, I have a bias about this. It's because that's what I've always done. That's how my people think. But maybe I should, particular instance, so that we can get along together enough to create negotiation. Mm-hmm. You know, Constanza says that this is where the civility rules come in. You need to have an open discussion concerning the use of civility rules. Yeah, you don't have to change your mind exactly about everything, although it will get changed somewhat. But you need to have an open discussion about the civility rules. We will treat each other with respect. Mm-hmm. Rubio says you need to acknowledge the fear and negotiate on the issues at hand. Acknowledge the fear and negotiate on the issues at hand. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you need to have everybody acknowledge that we're different. Yeah, we've got some different ideas, but you know what? We all want the same outcome, the same goal, so let's work towards it and go beyond our cultural differences. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Shall we go on to preconceived notions, which is kind of a cultural different bias, isn't it? A preconceived notion. It's when you really have a real good idea about what somebody else is going to do or say or how they are and what their opinions are. Preconceived notion. You know, Kelsey and others, this is kind of the ultimate sentence. Kelsey and others are saying, get over it. And that was actually in capital letters, get over it. Mm-hmm. If you have a preconceived notion, just get over it, that you fear somebody because of a preconceived notion, or you fear doing something because of a preconceived notion. Yeah, that you won't like it, that it's not for you, that you can't. Mm-hmm. Yeah. James and others are saying that you need to deal with the participants as individuals, not as symbols of their group. Deal with the participants as individuals, not as symbols of their group. What a good point. Yes. And that's really what we advocate, isn't it, at Recipe for Peace Now? To deal with everybody on an individual basis and not because, well, somebody gave you a cultural bias, which you kind of came into the room with, but it wasn't even yours. It was something that you learned from respected adults, perhaps, as a child. Hmm? Or you have a preconceived notion because of some sort of a prior experience, which is a little different than a cultural bias because it is personal. Yeah. But still, as Kelsey says, we need to get over it. We need to work together for this specific issue at this specific time. I always say we don't have to be friends. But we do have to be respectful and get along with each other so that we can reach our common goal. Simple as that, yes. So this is where Recipe for Peace Now, and those of you who have been here before, thank you for coming back, have heard this, and I say it each time, I think, that when you have kind of a moment when people need to have a break, either you've been working really hard and everybody's getting tired, or things are getting a little bit less than civil, they're kind of heading in that direction, and you need to have a time out, it's good to have some food in the room because it gives us something nice to do together that has nothing to do with the issues at hand. And we get to know each other better as people too, right? You know, networking is an overused term, but it really is true. And the food is a tool. It's not because we're hungry, even though we might be. I mean, it might be dinner time. But the food is really used as a tool to get us to get together and talk to each other as individuals, because we will find some common interests, some common ground, and it will blow away the biases and the preconceived notions and the fears, because we will understand each other better, at least for this specific moment, so that we can get things done. And I see that we're kind of short on time. I think we're going to have just one recipe tonight, this show. And I say this each time, but it's very important. If you're going to have food, you need to take a survey amongst the participants and find out if anybody has an allergy to food, a prohibition, or a religious prohibition. It's a convivial good time. You don't want anybody to get sick or offended or something. You want everyone to have a nice time. It's meant as a good thing to get together and well, have something nice to eat. It's all fun. And it keeps everybody in the room and talking to each other. Also, you need to ask people to label the food. Not what is it called, meatloaf, but what is in it, so that they can determine if they can eat it, if it's got something that they can't eat. Yes. So you may have everybody make a list. And also, I think, primarily because I hate running out of food, that the host, which is usually us, should have a little extra, because not everybody brings enough for the potluck. And also, I think that we should have a safe recipe. What's a safe recipe? Too many ingredients. And the ingredients would be familiar to the participants. They would have eaten it before. So my safe recipe may be different than yours, because this is a global show, but something that your people would have eaten before, be familiar with, and you've taken the survey, so there is no prohibition against the ingredients. Now, I used a vegetable coconut curry as my safe recipe, and I have been informed by quite a few people that coconut is a fairly common allergy. And you know, I did not know that. So this might actually be an adventure recipe, because it violates one of the safe recipe rules. It has an ingredient in it that people are often allergic to that doesn't really show. And from now on, when I make this, I will grate coconut, or I will use flake coconut. In the United States, it comes in a bag, really. You don't have to mess with fresh coconut. But I will sprinkle coconut on the top so that it is readily seen that there is coconut in here. And it's not a necessity. You can substitute vegetable stock. In fact, maybe you should, because it would make it a safer recipe. Yeah, because it's got coconut milk in it, but it doesn't really have to. It would be perfectly nice if you got rid of that and just substituted you could substitute milk, I think. Have to think about it. Have to think about how it blends. But anyway, I'm going to put coconut on the top so you can plainly see it. So here we go. Vegetable coconut curry. Put coconut on the top. We're going to add flaked coconut. Here it comes in a bag, but you could probably get it in bulk. So we're going to have 2 tablespoons of oil. Let's have 2 onions that we're going to chop up. It's really nice in it. 2 tablespoons of a very mild curry, like a curry paste. That may also make it a not-so-safe recipe, because curry's a little unusual around here. I think this is the adventure recipe. People are going, yes, the adventure recipe. I'm going to use a can of chopped tomatoes, like a 16-ounce, and I'm going to use the broth, the juice in the tomatoes, use the whole can. you want to use fresh ones, go ahead. You will have a better product than I will. You may need to add a little liquid, a little bit of water to this to keep it a little bit of liquid. Mm-hmm. Actually, you could add tomato, like a diluted tomato juice. But I'm really going to use chopped canned tomatoes. They're delightful. Let's have a half cup of yogurt. Please do not use the very low-fat stuff. And, you know, if it has whey, that water that accumulates on yogurt, don't stir it in. Throw it out. Drain it off. Mm-hmm. In fact, oftentimes, if I'm not using what in the States they call a Greek yogurt, it makes it a very thick yogurt. If it's not a nice thick yogurt, I will actually drain the yogurt through cheesecloth to get some of the water out. All you do is you plop it off and you drain it through the cheesecloth. You just plop it into the cheesecloth and so that it can drain and the whey will drip out of it. I like it to be nice and thick. Mm-hmm. Let's have a cup of coconut milk. Unless somebody's allergic, and then don't do it, but make that very clear. 4 sliced carrots. Let's have about a cup of cauliflower, the little florets. Quite frankly, I'm going to use frozen on all of this stuff. If you do as I do, well, not the carrots. Well, you could use the carrots, too, come to think of it. They come frozen. You need to thaw this and pat it dry. Mm-hmm. Let's have a package of green beans, like 8 ounces of it, and 2 cups of broccoli, the little florets. I don't like the stems. I know that people say it's wasteful, and they chop or they slice the stems in, the stalks, on the cauliflower and the broccoli. Ah, gee. If you're going to do it nice and thin at least. I guess it looks fine if you like to, but try to get kind of smallish ones and not the really wooden ones. I've had some interesting wooden vegetable stew in my day. Let's have a couple of zucchini that we're going to slice up. And how about 1/2 pound of mushrooms that we're going to slice? And, of course, we're going to make some steamed rice that we're going to serve on the side. Those of you who have been here before know that, and thank you for your participation and for coming back, know that I have a rice steamer that I'm quite fond of, and I do believe in putting stuff like that on the side. So now what are we going to do? We're going to heat up the oil, we're going to add the onion, and we're going to cook it until it's nice and translucent and soft. Then we're going to add the curry paste, and we're going to stir that all around with the onion. It takes about a minute. It smells wonderful. So you know it when it gets all incorporated and it smells lovely. And now let's turn the heat down because otherwise we're going to scorch. And we're going to add the chopped tomatoes, the yogurt, and the coconut milk. And we're going to combine them, right? And then we're going to add if we've used fresh carrot, this is the moment because it needs a little bit extra cooking. And we're going to simmer this whole thing uncovered for about 5 minutes. So it all gets incorporated, and it's all yummy, and it's all made sauce, so to speak. Now we're going to add the cauliflower and the eggplant because they're a little bit tougher, simmered for about 5 minutes. Now we're going to stir in everything else. This is an easy recipe. It's kind of like, well, put it all together, heat it up. There we've got it. We're going to stir in all the remaining ingredients. And we're going to keep simmering it. You've got to keep giving it a little bit of a stir unless you're using a nonstick pot because you don't want it to stick to the bottom and kind of scorch. So you don't have to stir it constantly, but I like to give it a stir frequently because you're going to cook this whole thing uncovered because we're simmering it. And it takes about 15 minutes to get this all incorporated and everything nice and soft and not mushy, but the right consistency. There you have it. Very delicious. It looks lovely with all the colors. Has a lovely fragrance because of the curry and the coconut milk. And we're now going to, a lot of people are voting that this be an adventure recipe. Because of the curry and the coconut milk, okie dokie, let's do it. And yes, you can add a protein. This is actually lovely with chicken. Mm-hmm. Chicken is really nice if you're going to use chicken, you need to cook it first. Well, you could simmer it to cook it, but you have to remember, of course, that when you were doing the browning part, that you need to brown, you need to cube the chicken. In fact, breasts is always nicer, but you need to take it off the bones and cube it and brown it on all sides and really cook it through, basically, and then put it into simmer and soak up the juices and the taste. I'm very much in favor of pre-cooking chicken. Chicken's kind of, it's not something that you should chance having raw in your, being kind of rare in the middle. It's not only icky, it's probably not particularly healthy. So yeah, I'm greatly in favor of cooking it. So there you have it. If you'd like to add the other things, well, of course. I actually, you know, this has been pointed out to me, and it's really true. I actually recommend serving kind of not so spicy. People are saying it could use more curry and like that. Well, I recommend serving it kind of on the bland side and putting condiments that are carefully labeled to the side so everybody knows that, you know, a nice chutney never hurt this. But it's not something I would put in. I would put it to the side. Yes, along with coconut. People go, put coconut, put dishes of coconut to the side, that too. So that is our, well, I thought it was our safe recipe. It's kind of a medium safe recipe. Delicious, easy to do, very popular, and you serve the steamed rice on the side. And I see that our time together is nearly up. Thank you for being here. Thank you for all of your participation and for listening. If you would like to contact us, we're at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. Our website is recipeforpeacenow.com. The last 5 shows, including this one, just as soon as we get off the air, are archived on our website at recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last 5, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your participation. Thank you for listening. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.